So tonight I want to talk about a famous sutta. Please forgive my Pali pronunciation. It's the Kakakupama Sutta, which is often called the simile of the saw. And the first thing I want to point out is actually this sutta is sort of a collection of stories and similes that the Buddha is using to teach the meaning of right action and right speech in relation to other people, how we interact with other people, and what they say and do. This is an area where we're often very reactive, where we respond automatically and sometimes quite self-righteously. So it's a rich place for mindfulness in daily life, to see where we can wander from what is wholesome quite easily. So I'm just going to sort of share the pieces of the sutta and then talk about them and then relate them to some other things that other teachers have said as well. So the first story begins in verse 5, where some people, some other members of the Sangha have complained that this monk Paguna is behaving improperly. And this is the Buddha questioning him. Paguna, is it true that you are associating overmuch with bhikkhunis? So this is a monk hanging out with the nuns. That is, that you are associating so much with bhikkhunis that if a bhikkhu speaks dispraise of those bhikkhunis in your presence, you become angry and displeased and make a case of it. And if any bhikkhu speaks dispraise of you in those bhikkhunis' presence, they become angry and displeased and make a case of it. Are you associating too much with bhikkhunis, as it seems? Yes, venerable sir. Paguna, are you not a clansman who has gone forth out of faith from home life into homelessness? Yes, venerable sir. So the Buddha is saying, but haven't you taken, the vows of one who's gone forth, become a monk? Because this sort of behavior would not be appropriate for a monk, essentially. Paguna, and this, the Buddha goes on, Paguna, it is not proper for you, a clansman gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, to associate overmuch with bhikkhunis. Therefore, if anyone speaks dispraise of those bhikkhunis in your presence, you should abandon any desire and any thought based on the household life. And herein you should train. Thus, my mind will be unaffected, and I will utter no evil words. I shall abide compassionate for his welfare, with the mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. This is how you should train, bhikkhuna. If anyone give those bhikkhunis a blow with the hand, with a clod, with a stick, or with a knife in your presence, you should abandon any desire and any thought based on the household life. And herein you should train yourself. And he goes on and lists all the things that the people might do to the bhikkhunis. And then, it's just an interesting thing because, in our mind, our householder minds, we're going, oh, wait a second, I should defend those people, right? They're being disparaged, and I should, it's almost like it's right to get angry at people who are doing nasty things to the bhikkhunis, right? But the Buddha's trying to make two points here. That Paguna felt it was right for him to defend the nuns. And the nuns felt dependent on him and felt they needed to defend him. Both of these thoughts are not proper for someone who's gone forth, someone who's a monastic, right? Someone who's taken vows. The monks should understand that the nuns are perfectly capable of dealing with the situation. They don't need his protection. And the monks should understand that part of their training is to stand on their own, In both cases, their mind should be unaffected. Their mutual duty is to practice. And expressing anger isn't wholesome. It's identification with self. The idea that there is someone who has been spoken about harshly or unfairly. This is, you know, in the context of the story, this is about bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. But this is really important advice for us. I think especially in these times where there's so much going on, where it's pretty easy to sort of get wound up and angry. And we go, oh my God, what about this now they're doing that? And how can he do this? And oh, you know, we just have those little internal rants, or maybe we have rants with other people we're having conversations with. And it's like, at some level, we're thinking that what's going on in the world isn't right. It's affecting me. I'm being treated unfairly in a very broad sense when it comes to things going on in the world. But even, you know, we have these conversations with people sometimes, and they say something, and it's like, wait a second, how could you possibly believe that? And we get wound up. Now it becomes very personal even. There's this great statement I came across once when it talked about anger. And it's really important to try and remember this. All anger, this is like, all anger arises from thwarted lust or wounded pride. Isn't that an amazing thought? All anger arises from thwarted lust or wounded pride. So thwarted lust, this is lust in the broadest sense of the word, meaning desire for something. So we have a desire to be looked upon as wise. And someone says something, you know, to put us down and say, you don't have a clue what you're talking about. Then we get angry. But it's because of, not because of what they said, but out of our desire to feel like we're wise. Our self-image has been attacked. And this always is just a way to create more, a bigger sense of a separate self. I've created a sense of self of someone who knows something, and these people are somehow or other don't get it how wise I am. Therefore, they must be wrong, blah, 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 blah. And we get caught in that space quite easily. Joseph Goldstein, of course, has something to say about this as well. This is from his book, Insight Meditation. And he's talking about how our emotions can bind us. Our great challenge and potential is to learn how to stay open to the whole range of feeling without adding this extra sense of I and mine in the midst of it. One practical device that often helps is to see three things going on in the midst of a strong emotion. I think this is really interesting what he's saying here. When we become angry, for example, there's some external situation prompting the anger to arise. Someone is doing or saying something that we do not like or we feel is harmful to ourselves or others. Second, there's our reaction to that situation, namely the feeling of anger. The third component is the relationship of our mind to the anger itself. So that's interesting. It's like, oh, and here's the third thing you should pay attention to, right? Usually we are lost in the first two. The external situation and our reaction to it. Something happens, we get angry. As we get angry, we start thinking about what happened. All those thoughts create more anger, which in turn creates more thoughts about the situation, often with blame, self-righteousness, and hurt feelings. Thus, we quickly become caught in a destructive loop. If you seek a way out of such cycles, try turning your attention away from the situation and your reaction toward it, and toward the third component, the relationship of your mind to the emotion, whether it is anger, fear, or whatever. For example, in the midst of a whirlwind of anger, you might ask yourself, how am I getting caught in this anger? How am I being hooked by it? How am I identifying with it? So look at what was the root, not of the story, not of the conversation, not of the whatever, but what is it internally in your own world that has caused this eruption, right? Asking form of that question is completely different from considering the external situation. At such a time, we are no longer sending out threads of blame that bind us to the situation, to the reaction, and to our identification with emotion. We are no longer thinking about the external causes of the anger, so we are no longer feeding it. So, step back and look at the anger, energy of anger itself. And see if you can see why this is driving you so strongly. We also do not ask the question for the purpose of getting an answer. That's an interesting thought. How you ask a question and expect no answer? It's like just asking the question itself. Rather, the question's purpose is to help us change perspective, to take responsibility for what arises in our mind. In the moment of asking, how am I getting hooked? We've already moved outside the anger and are looking at the way we are relating to it. It is possible in that moment for the whole mass of anger to dissolve without our denying it, repressing it, or shoving it away. Which is often, if we feel guilty about being angry, then we start to repress it and try and shove it away and pretend it isn't there. This is just, we traded one powerful emotion storm for another. Right? We trade the anger for shame. Well, that's really useful, right? It's like we have to look at it and just look, be mindful of it without having to make a big deal out of it, right? It's this is really great advice, and it's something that's really hard to do because we get so caught up in the emotional storms that to step back like that and just go, oh, what's going on here? That's my form of that question is, what's going on? Just sometimes I'll ask myself, what's going on? And just this, that makes me pause and look at the underlying story of all this as opposed to my individual righteousness often. So that's at the same time, and this is in reference to that story about the bhikkhunis, we should defend those who need protection. It's also very true in this current culture and what's going on in the world, but not from a place of anger or blame. Can we defend from a place of an open heart? Can we defend even at the same time with thoughts of loving kindness and compassion towards the perpetrators? Can we go, I don't need to attack them. I don't need to think they're wrong or bad. Can we operate in that way? It's a very different idea of how to do things. So then the Buddha goes on. This is a few more verses here. Bhikkhus. There was an occasion when the bhikkhus satisfied my mind. Here I address the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, I eat at a single session. By doing so, I am free from illness and affliction, and I enjoy lightness, strength, and a comfortable abiding. Come, bhikkhus, eat a single session. By so doing, you will be free from illness and affliction, and you will enjoy lightness, strength, and a comfortable abiding. And I had no need to keep on instructing those bhikkhus. I had only to arouse mindfulness in them. Suppose there were a chariot or even ground at the crossroads, harnessed two thoroughbreds, waiting with gold line ready, so that a skilled trainer, a charioteer of horses to be tamed, might mount it, and taking the reins in his left hand and the gold in his right hand, might drive out and back by any road, wherever he likes. So too I had no need to keep on instructing those bhikkhus. I only had to arouse the mindfulness in them. And these bhikkhus took the teachings and ran with them, essentially. Therefore, bhikkhus, abandon what is unwholesome and devote yourself to wholesome states. For that is how you will come to growth, increase, and fulfillment in this Dhamma and discipline. Suppose there were a big solid tree grove near the village or town, and it was choked with castor oil weeds, and some man would appear desiring its good welfare and protection. He would cut down and throw out the crooked saplings that rob the sap. He would clean up the interior of the grove and tend the straight, well-formed saplings, so that the solid tree grove later on would come to growth, increase, and fulfillment. So too, bhikkhus, abandon what is unwholesome and devote yourself to wholesome states. For this is how you will come to growth, increase, and fulfillment. So here he's using this image of cleaning out a sala tree, which is some kind of tree that grows in India. I don't know what it is. But he's saying basically, you know, get it together and see what's wholesome and try and act and live through with intention in that way. Just like if you're the sala grove full of weeds is like our minds. Right? That's the simile here. And he's saying, we've got to tend to our minds. Tend to what's going on in your mind and heart. And try and act and speak in a wholesome way all the time. Be aware of that. Make all your decisions based on the idea, is this wholesome? Is this useful? Does this lead me forward? And then act that way. And not get caught up in all the ranting that we sometimes get caught in. I used to belong and was very active in a group of people from what's called the Shivananda Yoga Vedanta Ashram. I was with them for 15 years back in the 80s and 90s. And Swami Shivananda, who is the saint in India, had this saying that he used all the time. And it was like, it was actually, you know, there would be little songs that we would sing that would help us remember this, right? But this is a really famous quote. It says, bare insult, bare injury, highest yoga. Bare insult, bare injury, highest yoga. This is like the ideal, was to be able to not have, don't be reactive. Don't need to strike back. Just, and this doesn't mean you sort of become wishy-washy milquetoast and just let people get away with anything, but you don't need to be reactive towards them. And there's this long story. Formerly, because and the same. In the same Savatthi, there was a housewife named Vedika, and a good report about Mrs. Vedika had spread thus. Mrs. Vedika is gentle. Mrs. Vedika is meek. Mistress Vedika is peaceful. Now, she had a maid named Kali, who was clever, nimble, and neat in her work. The maid Kali thought, a good report about my lady had spread thus. How is it now, when she does not show anger, is it nevertheless actually present in her, or is it absent? Or else is it just because my work is neat and my lady shows no anger, though it is actually present in her? Suppose I test my lady. So now, one little thing to note, Kali in the Hindu pantheon is a troublemaker. She's sort of the goddess of destruction. Right, so the fact that he would choose Kali as the name of this made is interesting in just that's his cultural heritage, right? So the maid Kali got up late. Then Mrs. Vedika said, "Hey, Kali, what is it, madam? What is the matter that you got up so late?" "Nothing is the matter, madam. Nothing is the matter, you wicked girl. Did you get up so late?" And she was angry and displeased, and she scowled. Then the maid thought, "The fact is that while my lady does not show anger, it is actually present in her, not absent. And it is just because my work is neat, and my lady shows no anger, though it is actually present in her, not absent. Suppose I test my lady a little more." So she keeps showing up later and later, and poking her mistress more and more. So the maid Kali got up still later in the day. Then Mistress Vedika said, "Hey, Kali, what is it, madam? What is the matter? You get up still later in the day. Nothing is the matter, madam. Nothing is the matter, you wicked girl. And you get up late still later every day." And she was angry and displeased, and she took a rolling pin and gave her a blow on the head and cut her head. So the mistress finally lost it, in other words. Then the maid Kali, with blood running from her cut head, denounced her mistress to the neighbors. "See, ladies, the gentle ladies work. See, ladies, the meek ladies work. See, ladies, the peaceful ladies work. How can she become angry and displeased with her only maid for getting up late?" Once again, this is like a contrived sort of thing. But basically, what the Buddha is trying to get across here is, it's easy to be calm and peaceful, and to appear calm and peaceful when everything's going smoothly. You know, when the maid's doing really good work and not being very efficient. It's not so easy when it's not going smoothly. So the real test is when things go wrong, especially if it affects you. People often appear holy or put on the appearance of being holy just to get what they want or to be praised. Suppressed emotions always come out in the end, often in unpleasant ways. And this is something we have to be aware of in ourselves. It's like, are we, you know, "Oh, I'm not one of those serious, you know, Buddhist practitioners. You know, I never get angry. I'm just calm, and see how calm I am," sort of vibe, which is really easy to fall into, and just sort of like as if you know, floated a few feet above the floor most of the time in your display of who you are. And be aware that that often can be just a facade, either in yourself or in someone else. You know, there's lots of stories of people who put on that thing and become great teachers, and then something happens and the whole thing goes poof in various ways. Then the Buddha goes on, and this, here's another line here. And he's talking about speech in the broadest sense. This is actually a very famous teaching of the Buddha, this verse. "Bhikkhus, there are five courses of speech that others may use when they address you. Their speech may be timely or untimely, true or untrue, gentle or harsh, connected with good or with harm, spoken with a mind of love and kindness or with inner hate. When others address you, their speech may be timely or untimely. When others address you, their speech may be true or untrue." This is where it goes through the whole list again. "Hearing because you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare state. With the mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. We shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And starting with him, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness." So he's saying, no matter how people attack you or don't attack you, because they can either speak with loving kindness or with the opposite, and so on. And it's like, that's just the way things are. It's what the Buddha is saying, in a sense. This is, he's just like making sure we understand that this is just life. Life is full of people who are kind to us and speak kindly to us, and people who speak harshly to us. And this is an interesting, this is an additional interesting little tidbit about this. This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. He's talking about speech. But there's another side to speech, which is equally important and something we probably don't pay a lot of attention to sometimes. It's a place where we can really work on our mindfulness practice. Right speech also has implications for how we listen. The Buddha outlined a practice for staying mindful of how another person is addressing us without getting caught up in our own reactivity. And even more than that, he enjoins us to abide compassionate for their welfare and with a mind of loving kindness. Listening with compassion and loving kindness, even when harsh or untrue words are addressed at us, is a tremendously challenging aspect of mindfulness. And it's a good example of what it means to be mindful externally as well as internally. That's the teachings in the Satipatthana Sutta says this. Although such listening may seem very difficult to accomplish, in fact, many parents demonstrate it easily with their young children. Children in a moment of frustration or upset will yell at their parents, "I hate you!" And yet for many parents, at least much of the time, response remains loving. This practice would transform the world if people would begin to apply it throughout their lives. So much of the time when we're listening, we're not really listening, we're planning what we're going to say next. Right? And also we're being caught in reaction to what's being said instead of just being there listening. Open-hearted. I love this example about children, having been a parent myself and knowing exactly this story. We adopted a young girl when she was 7. And when she was going through one of her difficult phases, and she really wanted to get to me, she'd look me straight in the eye and she'd yell and she'd say, "Well, you're not my real father anyway." And it was like, "So you don't have any say in the situation, right?" And it was like, "How?" And I would just not react. It's the only way I could deal with it is to just not go there, because I could just see that she was just dying to sort of start a fight, essentially. And I was like, "That's what kids do." But here's the thing, that's what a lot of adults do too. You look at the world today, and there are adults in the world today who act exactly like this. You know, it's like that. You know, we had a little phrase in our family. We'd go when someone was going ranting like this, we'd go, "Nanny, nanny, boo boo." It was like just like what a bunch of nonsense was what we were saying, and it was just a way of dealing with it in some sense. There's another side to this list that we read, and that's that it's also, I see this in other places, you'll see this listed as just the wholesomes. This speech should be timely, true, gentle, connected with good, i.e. useful, and spoken with the mind of loving kindness. It's a good practice before we speak to make sure that we are about to meet all of these. Let's just look very briefly at them. Timely means, is this a good time? I mean, this person is like really upset about something, and now we're going to tell them something else because, well, it's my duty to let them know what's going on. And sometimes it's like the last thing you should do is let things calm down, and I can tell them this other thing that's going to get them more upset anyway. I can tell them later. I don't need to tell them right now. It's not timely. This is not that I shouldn't tell them. I just don't have to tell them right now. Is it true? Well, with that we have to make sure, right? Is it gentle? Can we even if we're giving bad news or criticism, can we do it in a gentle and calm way? So that it isn't like belligerent truth telling, I know what's good for you sort of vibe. Is it useful? Is what I'm about to say going to be useful to this other person or these other people? If it isn't going to be useful, why am I bothering to say it? Often I'm saying it to make myself feel important. Right? And is it spoken with the mind? Can I, if I'm speaking to this person, can I speak to them, but at the same time have a mind of loving kindness towards them? That's quite a, I think if people really did this, there'd be a lot less talking going on in the world, but that would be probably a good thing. Then the Buddha goes on. This is, like I said, this has got a lot of different images in this particular sutta. Bhikkhus, suppose a man came with a hoe and a basket and said, I shall make this great earth to be without earth. He would dig here and there, strew the soil here and there, spit here and there, and urinate here and there, saying, be without earth, be without earth. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Could that man make this great earth be without earth? No, venerable sirs. Why is that? Because this great earth is deep and immeasurable, so it is not easy to make it without earth. Eventually, the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. So too, Bhikkhus. There are five courses of speech, and then he basically says, this is, speech, you need to be non-reactive. If you're trying to fix things and dig a hole to get rid of all the earth, it's not going to be possible, right? Bhikkhu, suppose a man came with crimson, turmeric, indigo, or carmine and said, I shall draw pictures and make pictures appear on empty space. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Could this man draw pictures and make pictures appear in empty space? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because empty space is formless, and it is not easy to draw pictures there or make pictures appear there. Eventually, the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. So too, Bhikkhus, there are five courses of speech, but our minds will remain unaffected. And starting with him, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind similar to the empty space, abundant, exalted, immeasurable. One more. Bhikkhu, suppose a man came with a blazing grass torch and said, I shall heat up and burn away the river Ganges with this blazing grass torch. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Could the man heat up and burn away the river Ganges with the blazing grass torch? No, venerable sir. So, what's going on here? And what he's saying here is these are, when we're experiencing disagreeable speech from people, we somehow think we need to fix them or fix the situation. But that's like, trying to hoe away all the earth off the planet, or, dissolve all the water in the river Ganges. There are times when it's appropriate to speak, but even then, with this, we don't have to speak with the heart of loving kindness. But often it's just like, let that be, bear insult, bear injury, take it in, and feel like you just keep calm and have thoughts of loving kindness towards the person who's obviously caught in an unwholesome mind state. Understanding that, of course, if you do that, the person might get really angry because what they're looking for is their reaction. And they're going to get even angry because you're not reacting. And they'll sort of double down, right? Be prepared for that as well. And there's nothing you can do about that. It's just like that's how some people are, right? So. is something similar in thought. For instance, something from Sharon Salzberg. She's talking about someone who had sent a letter to the Inside Meditation Society accusing Sharon of not doing something properly and ranting about it. And her first impulse, she says, and this is like, well, I have to write a letter back accusing her of, you know, being unfair and blah, blah, blah. And then she realized, that's just, there I am, just fanning the flames, reacting with anger towards anger. And she goes on, she says it's quite wisely. How can we let go in such a situation? How can we change it? We can focus our attention more on the suffering of the situation, both our own and the suffering of others, rather than on our anger. So we can focus on how it makes us feel. What are we feeling right now in our hearts? As opposed to having to react. We can ask ourselves whom we are really angry at. Mostly what we are angry at is the anger in the other person. It is almost as if the other person were an instrument for anger that moves through them and motivates them to act in unskillful ways. We do not become angry at somebody's mouth when they are shouting at us. We are angry at the anger that is motivating them to shout. If we add anger to anger, it only serves to increase it. There's a well-known phrase, the Buddha said, hatred can never cease by hatred. Hatred can only cease by love. This is the eternal law. We can begin to transcend the cycle of aversion when we stop seeing ourselves personally as agents of revenge. It's my duty to get back at that person. That's how it's so easy to fall into that way of thinking. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, all beings are the owners of their own karma. If someone has caused harm, they will suffer. If we as karmas caused harm, we will suffer. It's stated so simply. Huh? I like that. Happiness or unhappiness depends on our own actions. If we fall into that cycle of anger and revenge and ranting, we never feel very good about it when it's all over. In fact, we feel the opposite. It's like kind of yucky, right? It's the opposite of happy, of creating more happiness in the world. All we've done is create more suffering for ourselves and for the other person. It just doesn't make sense, right? This is from the Dhammapada, just a couple of verses. And I like this particular bit. This has come down from old, Atula, and not from just today. They find fault with one who sits silent. They find fault with one who speaks a great deal. They find fault with one who measures his words. There's no one unfaulted in the world. No matter what you do, you don't speak at all. You speak too much. You speak very calmly with measured words. You'll get angry anyway. Someone's going to get angry with you no matter what. It's so true. It's like we have to understand. There never was, will be, not at present is found, anyone entirely faulted or entirely praised. You're going to get people finding fault with you. It's just the way it is. So to feel like you have to do something about it, feel like you have to get back at them, feeling like you have to correct them, it's like it's going to be endless. It'll never stop. And we see this with people in the political arena right now who think they have to, you know, always get even. Always, I have to react. I have to sort of deal with this right now. I can't let this go. I got to post something on Twitter about this, right? And it's just, it just perpetuates the whole thing. It just spins it and spins it and spins it. It doesn't ever end. Finally, we come to the simile of the saw. This is an interesting tidbit. Bhikkhus, even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handled saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teachings. Herein, bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected. We shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for the welfare, with the mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. Even if someone's sawing you apart with a two-handed saw. Now, this is for bhikkhus. Remember, bhikkhus had a much stricter world than us householders. But even if someone was trying to harm us physically, in other words, we should still have to keep a mind of loving kindness towards them. We can't blame them. There's a great story. It's a story I've heard that the Dalai Lama tells. And he was... this point, he escaped from from Tibet and was living in North India or Nepal, and he'd been there for like 20 years or so. But when he escaped, a lot of other monks were captured and treated really horribly. So finally, this monk that's been in prison for like 20 years and tortured and humiliated and just treated really horribly escapes from Tibet and makes his way to be with the Dalai Lama. And he's just so, the Dalai Lama is just so happy to see him. And then at one point, this monk is talking to the Dalai Lama. And he says, you know, there were some times when I was there in that prison for 20 years where I was really afraid. And the Dalai Lama says, well, of course you were. Like, they're treating, you know, look what they're doing. They're beating you and starving you and treating you terribly. Of course you were afraid. And the monk says, no. That's what I wasn't afraid of. I was afraid that I'd react unwholesomely to what they were doing. And you sort of step back. There's 20 years of being tortured. And his biggest fear was that he would react inappropriately, unwholesomely. This is someone who is taking the Buddha's teachings to heart and is living it out in a very powerful way. It's just some... There are people like that in the world, which is astonishing to me, I suppose. When I first heard that story, I was like, yeah, well. But that's the truth of things. There are people like that in the world that who are capable of that level of keeping their hearts open, no matter what. And I want to share this poem tonight to finish, just because it's one of my favorite Dana Fald's poems, I suppose. And it, in a way, reflects the thought that, you know, because a lot of what I've said tonight is like, yeah, you know, it's pretty easy to react. Well, yeah, but, you know, let's be real. You want me to, and then, you know, to let people disparage me for 20 years and I'm not going to sort of, what do you think I am, a holy man or something? But it's like, we have to start someplace, right? Why wait? And this is the poem, Awakening Now. Why wait for your awakening? The moment your eyes are open, seize the day. Would you hold back when the beloved beckons? Would you deliver your litany of sins like a child's collection of seashells, prized and labeled? No, I can't step across the threshold, you say, eyes downcast. I'm not worthy. I'm afraid. and my motives aren't pure. I'm not perfect, and surely I haven't practiced nearly enough. My meditation isn't deep, and my prayers are sometimes insincere. I still chew my fingernails, and the refrigerator isn't clean. Do you value your reasons for staying small more than the light shining through the open door? Forgive yourself. Now is the only time you have to be whole. Now is the sole moment that exists to live in the light of your true self. Perfection is not a prerequisite for anything but pain. This is a really, I think we should, I want to post this on my fridge sometimes. Perfection is not a prerequisite for anything but pain. Please, please, don't continue to believe in your disbelief. This is the day of your awakening. You know, we somehow think, oh, I have to be perfect. And all of the Buddhist teachings actually are pointing to how we can move towards perfection, which is a very different from being perfect. Can I just, everything I do, can I, through all my acts of speech and mind and body, as I live day to day in the world and as I do my practice and whatever I'm doing, can I actually move slowly towards being a little more perfect? Not thinking I have to be perfect, but can I move in that direction? It's all of the Buddhist teachings point to, it's all about the process. The end result will come by itself. Nothing we can do to make it happen anyway. So all we can do is be deep in the process. Can I keep moving slowly, slowly, slowly towards that ideal, understanding that I'm going to struggle and fail miserably sometimes and rant and do it, all those things I shouldn't know I shouldn't be doing or trying not to do. And we fail miserably. And then we start again. We move a little more and we've seen that, oh, that wasn't very, you know, I'm sure you've all experienced this. You say or do something and then you go, oh my God, how could I possibly have said or done that? That's the sign of being mindful. Like, at least you see that. A lot of people don't see that at all. They just keep going. The fact that we can pause and go, oh, that wasn't so cool, it's actually a sign of being quite skillful. Being mindful, even if it's not in the moment, at least we see it. That's very skillful. And then we learn from that, and the next time that sort of situation goes up, maybe there's a little less chance of us being reactive. That's all we can ever expect. Nothing more than that. Anyhow, that's all I have to share this evening.